This is the second part in a five-part interview series with Ilya Maslyansky on Russian internet manipulation. In this part, we will be talking about the Kremlin's offline responses to internet freedoms.
So now, with the chaos of the 2011 Duma elections passed, the Kremlin is now looking to preventing similar incidents from happening. And here we're getting into the main meat of your paper. You use Ron Deibert's model to distinguish between an online response and an offline response for information controls. So let's start with the offline version, that is, the manipulation of real-world institutions. Specifically, you mentioned the Russians passing a series of increasingly restrictive laws. What are these laws and what do they do?
I think this is a great place to sort of dive into the main body of my senior thesis because, chronologically speaking, this is exactly what I start my main body with, the offline response or, you know, the legislative changes, as we could call them indifferently. So the first thing that happened, and it actually happened really fast after the election, just a couple months later, the Russian government undertook this new initiative to create a series of blacklists to target extremist content. So when I speak of blacklists, let's go back to Ron Deibert's first generation controls, because right now we're talking about outright access denial. The site is blacklisted. ISPs or internet service providers have to comply with the message of the state. Game over, you can't access the website. So, and here, extremist content was purposefully defined very broadly and vaguely to allow the authorities to essentially target any kind of information that they disliked, then label it as extremist content, and get rid of it for good. So, you know, they started off with things like websites giving advice to people on how to commit suicide, to child pornography, and various things that they thought was linked to actual real-world terrorism. But, you know, very quickly they moved on from that and sort of expanded what they thought was extremist content. So, for example, something like public slandering of Russian officials is considered to be extremist behavior. And if there is information like that listed on your website that you are running from Russia, your website could be blacklisted. Internet service providers have to comply, and that's it. You don't have a website anymore. Going into actual laws that were passed, I would like to start with the so-called Bloggers Law, which is passed, I believe, in 2014. I might be off by 1 year, one way or another, but the Bloggers Law essentially stipulates that if you're a blogger, a Russian blogger, and you have more than 3,000 daily readers, you have to register with the authorities as a form of social media or a form of some form of news website, something like that, which means that you will give Roskomnadzor, which is Russia's communication watchdog, it's an agency within the Russian sort of governmental bureaucracy, your real name, your email, your address, your phone number, and all kinds of information that is, you know, often deemed private. And that, you know, the reasons behind this law was, again, to prevent people from publishing material of extremist nature online and for the government to sort of keep tabs on people and who wrote what. Because, you know, some popular bloggers in Russia are oppositionally minded. They don't like Putin very much, they don't like Medvedev very much, or the government governing party for that matter. So, you know, the reasons behind passing that law was, you know, to clearly keep tabs on these people who the government considered to be dangerous and able to undermine Kremlin's hold on power. Secondly, I would like to mention the so-called Foreign Agents Law, which stipulated that if you are a non-governmental agency in Russia and you are receiving any kind of foreign funding, you have to register with the authorities as a foreign agent, which means that you may be subjected to extra auditing, you know, random checks, and that any information that you publish has to be accompanied by a label of sorts that says that, oh, this information was published by a foreign agent. And just to give you an example of how, I'll use a strong word here, it's ridiculous, you know, how foreign funding is defined. For example, this organization, Golos, The Voice, the election watchdog, that tried to prevent, or rather tried to map, electoral violations in 2011, they were listed as a foreign agent and were asked to register as one. And if you refuse to register, you'll be fined and criminal charges will be pressed against you. They were asked to register as a foreign agent because an employee received a grant or some kind of, yes, I think it was a grant from Lithuania to a sum of $1,000. But even more ridiculous, Golos has a subsidiary in the Ural region called Golos Ural. And they received $18 from an unknown donor, and that constitutes foreign funding. So you received $18, you're a foreign agent, and now we will, you know, sort of keep tabs on and take a look, close look at what you publish. So, you know, clearly the authorities have been very generous with regards to who they label as a foreign agent and what constitutes grounds for being labeled as a foreign agent in the first place. Now, and this law is perhaps the most important one here in the broader context of what I'm talking about. It doesn't have a short and snappy name like the Blogger's Law or the Foreign Agents Law, but this law is nevertheless important because it required companies to store Russian users' data on Russian soil. So, let's say your social network, your Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, anything. And you have Russian users who register from the Russian Federation, have a Russian IP address associated with it. And, you know, obviously people list some kind of personal information about themselves there. So the Russian government passed a law that essentially said that, okay, if you are a social network or a, I don't know, news website, anything like that, and you have active Russian users, so I guess it mostly applies to social networks, you have to store Russian users' data on Russian soil, which means you have to relocate, you know, a portion of your servers. You need to have servers in Russia. And, you know, needless to say, this is a very dangerous law because it essentially tries to coerce big corporations like Facebook and Twitter into storing their data in Russia, which gives the Kremlin and the status quo direct access to information on millions and maybe tens of millions of Russian users. So this law was passed. You know, the big guys like Twitter and Facebook still haven't complied. And there is always talks between Roskomnadzor, the communications watchdog, and them to try to make things work. But you know, there has been a lot of pressure put on Facebook and Twitter to comply, because the screws are tightening on internet freedom in Russia, as we'll discover, you know, to an even greater extent as we go forward with what I have to say. And lastly, the Russian Federation updated its military doctrine in 2014. And what was new, and the previous version was released in 2010, what was new about the 2014 one is that now it listed uses of information that would seek to undermine, I don't know, the, well, you know, practically what it meant is that if you use information to undermine the status quo or the Kremlin's hold on power, that was listed as one of the main internal military threats. And to give you an idea of how seriously they took that, it was listed alongside things such as attempts to undermine Russia's constitutional order, good government, and things of that sort. And in 2010, there was no mention of this. So, and you know, and then you have, if you put things into perspective, you know, in 2010, the military doctrine didn't list uses of information as a main internal military threat. In 2011, we had the highly contested parliamentary election and the strong online and offline response by the Kremlin during the election, after the election. 2014, the doctrine gets updated, and you know, things like using information to undermine the political stability of Russia gets listed as one of the main internal military threats. So I would say that these are the major legislative or structural changes that have happened since 2011. And it has been in many ways a qualitative shift in how the Kremlin addresses the internet and social media and its oppositional mobilizing potential.
Like, all these attempts that you talk about seem to be the Russian state trying to re-territorialize the international globalized nature of the internet back onto Russian soil. But, you know, given that the internet is like a global infrastructure, like, it's very hard to control people's words and thoughts in that way, right? So, and of course, as you said, the private sector isn't necessarily beholden to the state. So, like the V-Contact owners.
Contact, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did Putin get around this problem? Was he able to successfully renationalize social media and the internet in Russia?
This is an excellent question. Yeah. And in some ways, what has happened is that the Kremlin has found a way to indirectly control the big players in the Russian social media sphere, like ВКонтакте. So in 2013, there was pressure exerted by the FSB, Russia's principal internal security agency. They exerted pressure on Pavel Durov, the founder of ВКонтакте, once again. Just to remind you and to the audience, in 2011, when they asked Durov to shut down protest groups for the parliamentary election, he simply refused and actually posted a copy of the summons on his Twitter. In 2013, they asked him to shut down Euromaidan groups. And, you know, Euromaidan was this huge political movement in Ukraine at the time. There were protests on the streets of Kiev against the Yanukovych government, because the government essentially in Ukraine took a U-turn on Ukraine's plans to strengthen its economic and political ties with the European Union. So the Ukrainians were protesting against that, and they were creating all kinds of opposition groups on ВКонтакте, which is also available in Ukraine. And the Russian authorities exerted pressure through the FSB on Durov to shut down these groups, because for the Kremlin it was crucial to be able to sell the official narrative of the political establishment in Russia regarding what was happening in the neighboring state of Ukraine to the Russian citizenry. And once again, Durov said no. Couple months later, the FSB pressured him once more. This time, they wanted him to shut down groups in support of Alexei Navalny, who is a prominent opposition leader in Russia. And once again, Durov said no. Well, this time, however, the FSB didn't take no for an answer. They did it twice, I guess, third time the charm. They didn't take no for an answer the third time, and they pressured Durov to sell his share of ВКонтакте, after which he fled the country. Durov was pressured by two pro-Kremlin oligarchs to sell ВКонтакте and to leave Russia. He sold it for about $300 million. It's a big, you know, it's a big company. It's a gigantic social network. It was his brainchild, and Durov cared a lot about internet freedom and, in general, things of that sort, essentially. And, you know, at the time when he was pressured by these prominent pro-Kremlin oligarchs, he would extensively post on his ВКонтакте page about the fact that, you know, he was pretty much done for. So in the end, yeah, as I said, he sold it and fled the country with no plans to return. As of now, ВКонтакте is primarily controlled by two pro-Kremlin oligarchs, which means that the Russian government has directly acquired indirect control of ВКонтакте, Russia's largest social media website, by, you know, essentially making these pro-Kremlin oligarchs take full ownership of it and getting rid of Pavel Durov, the only remaining strong player who had any interest in things like freedom of speech and expression on the internet. And I'd like to use another example. So there used to be this, I guess it still exists, but not in the same way that it used to, this news website in Russia called Lenta. It was an independent news website, and they got in some real trouble for publicizing an interview with the leader of a Ukrainian far-right party. Incidentally, the interview was conducted by a journalist who reported and exposed carousel voting in 2011. So, you know, we have some clear parallels between, you know, what happened in 2011 and what happened years later. So, Lentaroux was accused of publishing content of extremist nature, and very quickly the owner of Lenta, who was, and still is, a Russian billionaire called Alexander Mamut, he accused, you know, essentially his own people, his own news network, of an insufficiently pro-Russian coverage of the events in Ukraine. Mamut, the owner of Lenta, was very quick in his dismissal of Timchenko, who was the chief editor of Lenta. The whole publication actually left in protest because he fired Galina Timchenko. They didn't want to work for a news website that came under Kremlin's indirect control because, you know, and this is no surprise here, a pro-Kremlin person was very quick to replace the news editor, the chief news editor, who was fired. And before leaving, the employees published a statement on the website. That statement, I think, perfectly summarizes the state of Russian news media at the time, and it's so utterly fascinating, I would like to, you know, just read it out.
Mm-hmm.
So what they said is the following. Russia has seen a dramatic decrease in independent journalism over the past few years. Some publications are directly controlled by the Kremlin, others through curators, and yet others by editors who are afraid of losing their jobs. Some media outlets have already closed, and others will close in the months to come. We're not concerned about the fact that we have nowhere left to work. Instead, we fear that you've got nothing left to read.
Yeah, that's the Kremlin's very thorough and wholesale response to real-world media institutions and real-world media figures. The thing is that, as we shall find out later in your paper, not only have the Russians got nothing left to read, they got something even worse. They got information that was polluted by government agents.